All right. Good morning, everybody. 11:17, Wednesday, October 6th. And we're going to start alcohols today. So we're going to do the alcohol chapter. And the rest of the chaos around my house is still going on. And I may get interrupted in this at some point. We'll see. But see how well this goes. All right. Let me go ahead and start a screen share. And then let's talk about some alcohols. This chapter is actually split into two chapters, I believe. The first part is reactions of alcohols or structure of alcohols a little bit, acidity of alcohols and these types of things. And then we get into a second chapter that deals more in depth with some of the reactions of the alcohols. So this is alcohols and phenols. And let's do a little bit of nomenclature first. For nomenclature, if we wanted to name an alcohol, and we're looking at the different functional groups that we can have present in the same molecule. We can have an alkene and we can have an alcohol. The parent chain must include the hydroxyl group. The hydroxyl group takes priority over the alkene and over alkynes. So when we're looking at priorities, it's alkenes, which are less than alkynes, which are less than alcohols. And so the alcohols take priority out of all the functional groups. And so the main chain must contain the alcohol. With that main chain, we want the longest chain possible that contains the alcohol. So we go through and one direction there and I can't step back because I did it only one line. Usually what we want is for that main chain to contain the majority of the functional groups too. We want the alkene and the alcohol. But as we go through and number it, the numbering system, we want 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We want the lowest possible number. To the hydroxyl group. And then we identify substituents that are located additionally into that. And so then we can start sort of blocking it out that we have a 4,5-dimethyl. We have a 5-ene, that's the start of the double bond. We have a 2-all, that's where the alcohol is located. And it's a 6-carbon chain, so this is a hex for the 6-carbon chain. And then when we put the name together, any stereochemistry, if there were stereochemistry in this molecule, we would put the stereochemistry out in front. No stereochemistry was designated in this molecule, so we'll skip the stereochemistry component. But we start off by listing the substituents in alphabetical order, 4,5-dimethyl. And then we go to the hex, the parent chain. We list the subunit, the 5-ene. And we don't list the ene, we just list the en for the ene, that signifies the double bond. And then the dash and the 2 and the all. 4,5-dimethyl-hex-5-ene-2-all is how we would go through and name that. So it's just pulling all of the parts And then once you've got all the parts, assembling those parts in the right order is the way that I sort of like to block out with the nomenclature. And you guys are responsible for nomenclature for each chapter that we go through and each new functional group that we add. We do want to have a nomenclature component of each one of those and an understanding of that nomenclature. If we have something that is, like I said, has stereochemistry in it, so we can do this way. Here, what we would want to do is we want to give the lowest possible number to the alcohol. So this would be number one. We would number in this case to get the lowest possible number for the geminal methyls. We would want to go around counterclockwise. And so the parts here would include a one all, a 3-3 dimethyl. We have a cyclopent is the parent component. And then we need the stereochemistry. So we need to understand what the stereochemistry is with this hydrogen. And what I would suggest is that when you need to do stereochemistry, that you write it over again, separate from any other numbering that you've done, so that you can clearly see what needs to happen. Priority number one is going to be the alcohol, highest atomic number for prioritization. The lowest number is going to be number four, is going to be the hydrogen. And then we need to decide going around this direction or this direction, which one has higher priority. As we come out here, this is a CH2. And this one is likewise a CH2. So there's no difference in those CH2 groups. Then we come out here and here. This is a carbon that is connected to another carbon and two hydrogens. That's another CH2 group. This is another way of writing it out. This carbon, however, is connected to three other carbons. And the three other carbons takes priority. So this one takes priority over the bottom one. That means that this side is going to be number two, and this side is going to be number three. Now, taking all of that, I need to orient the hydrogen in the back. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of look from the back side and look at it this direction, and I'm going to draw a Newman projection, which puts the hydrogen directly in back. And then I'm going to put the OH up. And as I do that, I'm going to think about this as a ring system. And on this ring system, if I grab that hydrogen and turn this thing around, I'm going to find that those methyls are over here on the right-hand side. So this is going to be priority one, priority two, priority three. And we can see that we're sweeping around in a clockwise fashion. And a clockwise fashion is an R stereocenter. So this is an R stereocenter. And that is going to be one R as the stereocenter. So I'll combine all of those things into a name now. And that name will go one R. Actually, with just one stereocenter, it's redundant to put the number. So I don't need the number. But it's an R dash 3-3 dimethyl. And then no dash, cyclopent dash one dash all. And that would be my final name there. All right, how did you guys keep up? Is that cool?
I have a question.
Please.
So I thought that a stereocenter had to have four different groups coming off of it. But I see that there's the CH2s at two and three. So that's confusing me.
Okay. Solid question. When we have a stereocenter, you are right that a stereocenter is where there are four different groups. So we can think about A, B, C, and D. And that stereo center, there are other types of stereo centers that are not even tetrahedral. We can get into a discussion of that later on, and I can show you things that don't have tetrahedral centers that are stereo centers. But you're right, that they should have four different groups on it in order for it to be a stereo center. And so if we take something that is an alcohol on a five-member carbon, and I put the OH back and the hydrogen forward, that there is no stereo center here, because coming around the right-hand side and the left-hand side is the same. And because of that, what we do is we get a plane of symmetry that cuts down the molecule, and any molecule can be pancaked, so that if I drew this guy and put the hydroxyl group up and the hydrogen back, which looks like it would be an isomer, if I flip it over, it's the same thing, right? However, if I change it and I take and put put a substituent on it such that I make this into a bromide, or even just a methyl, maybe that's even fine. We'll just make a CH3 group here. All of a sudden now, the right-hand side and the left-hand side are different. This is a CH2. And the way that I would do this is I would do it this way. Right here is a carbon, which is connected to, let's say that this is A. So that's going to be carbon A, hydrogen, and hydrogen. And let's say that this is B. This guy here is a carbon, which is connected to a carbon B, a carbon, let's say that that's C, and the hydrogen that is also in that position. And that makes them different, right? This one is connected to two carbons and a hydrogen. This is connected to one carbon and two hydrogens. And so I can clearly see the difference there. The difference doesn't matter how far away the difference is. So that if I take and extend it out and I put the methyl over here, these are both CH2s. And so what happens is this is a carbon connected to a carbon, a hydrogen, and a hydrogen. This one, likewise, is a carbon connected to a carbon, a hydrogen, and a hydrogen. So they're the same. So I extend out and I go one more step. And I say, is there a difference at this level? And the carbon connected to a carbon, another carbon, and a hydrogen. And then over here, this is a carbon connected to a carbon, a hydrogen, and a hydrogen. And so this becomes the higher priority. And it is a difference on one side versus the other. It doesn't matter how far the difference is. So I can have a hydroxyl group sitting here and a hydrogen here. And I could take this chain out and I could take this chain out here. And if I take this and just put a bromide or anything, all of a sudden it becomes chiral. It doesn't matter how far away that group is, because what it does is it makes two different groups on either side. And so I could even take and put a deuterium out here, and the deuterium would be enough to make this a stereoisomer. And it doesn't matter how far away it is. It just has to be at some point in the chain a different group that makes the left-hand side and the right-hand side different. And distance isn't important.
Okay, cool, thank you.
Yeah, and that can be really misleading for sure, particularly when we get with ring systems. That can be misleading when we particularly get with ring systems. So that's a little review on stereoisomerism. Okay, with nomenclature, there are also many common names. For alcohols. We've got isopropanol. which can also be 2-propanol, which could also be propan-2-ol. And so all three different ways of naming this guy. Same thing here. We've got tert-butanol. And this one could be called, besides tertiary butanol, it could be 2-methyl propan-2-ol is the other name for that. This guy is called phenol, and that's its IUPAC name. And this one, benzyl alcohol. And so a lot of common names with the alcohols too, with the smaller alcohols. When we look at these guys, and those common names are used interchangeably with their IUPAC names. When we start to look at alcohols, unlike other molecules, we start to classify these, or other functional groups, I should say, we start to classify these. And so classification becomes an important component. In classification, we look at primary alcohol, secondary alcohol, tertiary alcohol. So we classify them into primary, secondary, or tertiary, and sometimes we use the word terminal as being on the end of a chain, as being a terminal alcohol or primary alcohol. And that word gets thrown around sort of interchangeably. Whether an alcohol is primary, secondary, or tertiary is telling you about the carbon that it sits on. So that we have a primary carbon, a secondary carbon, a tertiary carbon. And so while the alcohol is said to be primary, secondary, or tertiary, that primary, secondary, or tertiary is telling you about the type of carbon that it sits on. This is really different from the way that we do amines and whether an amine is primary, secondary, or tertiary. And so this is why we generally want to highlight it, because with an amine, when we look at an amine, the amine here is primary. The amine here is primary. And the amine here is primary. What makes an amine primary, secondary, or tertiary is not what carbon it's on, but how many carbons are connected to it. So with an amine, when we look at it, the difference between these is that if I have one R group and 2 hydrogens, this is a primary amine. And with 2 R groups, it becomes a secondary amine. And with 3 R groups, it becomes a tertiary amine. And so primary and secondary and tertiary with amines is very different than it is with alcohols, because it's about how many groups are on the nitrogen itself. So with alcohols, it's about the carbon that they sit on. With amines, it's about the number of R groups that are attached. And nitrogens can actually have 4 carbons. And so there's one more here. And this is called quaternary. And I meant to put a positive charge there, not a dot. So this is called a quaternary. It's a quaternary ammonium ion. All right, so the differences between alcohols and amines, which gets important a little bit later on. From here, we're going to cover a little bit of physical properties. And so let's look at with physical properties, when we look at constitutional isomers, we find that they have very different boiling points. And so what is the reason for these differences in boiling points? Dimethyl ether versus ethanol. They have the exact same formula, same mass. So it's a C2H 456 O. They have the exact same mass, but vastly different boiling points. Dimethyl ether is a gas at room temperature. It needs to be cooled down to minus 24 degrees Celsius to become a liquid. Ethanol is a liquid that boils at 78 degrees Celsius. So what is it about ethanol that makes it have such a higher boiling point than the dimethyl ether? What physical property is it about it?
Well, it's more polar.
It is more polar. But they are both polar, but it is more polar. So I could look at it and I could say that these each have a dipole moment to them, and that this one has a dipole moment that sort of shoots, let's shoot it this way. So this would be partial minus and partial positive. However, the dipole moment, as you said, is that it is more polar. And so I would concur, and the way that we do more polar is we do a larger line. So this would be a small minus, small positive. This is larger positive, larger minus. So it is more polar. But polarity alone doesn't account for that size of dipole moment, or of a difference in boiling point.
Is it because it's protic? It's the hydrogen attached directly to the oxygen?
Yes. Can you expand on that? You're right. What is it about being protic that gives it stronger intermolecular attractive forces?
I would just think that it's the bond strength between the oxygen and the hydrogen.
That would be about the internal bonding. So boiling point is about trying to pull two molecules apart from each other. And if I want to pull two molecules apart from each other, then what I'm talking about is the ability to do this, to bond between them using the lone pairs, to bond partial positive to partial minus. And this is hydrogen bonding. Alcohols have the ability to do hydrogen bonding, and the hydrogen bonding makes them both higher in boiling point, stronger intramolecular attractive forces, IMF forces, and that is as compared to dipole-dipole moment, where these guys stack up, and so I'm looking at partial minus to partial positive, but there's no hydrogen bonding. This is just dipole-dipole. So the dipole-dipole are definitely weaker forces. than those stronger hydrogen bonding forces. Those hydrogen bonding forces also allow alcohols to be able to interact with other things. So they can not only hydrogen bond with themselves, but they can hydrogen bond with other hydrogen containing molecules where the hydrogen is connected to an oxygen such as water. So this allows for H bonding with water. This goes to the idea of like dissolves like. And that like dissolves like idea means that alcohols have increased water solubility. So it really depends upon the size of the alcohol, but I do this in Chem 30A when I teach Chem 30A, and it makes sense with Chem 30A students. It makes sense with organic chemistry students too, that I treat this guy, that is not a very good drawing, I treat this guy like a tractor and a trailer, that the hydroxyl group, because of its hydrogen bonding, because of its polar nature, allows it to pull the carbons into water. Let's say water solubility. And it has only so much strength, which means that this part that is out here is hydrophobic. And this part is hydrophilic. And the number of carbons that it can drag in is really about 3 to 4 carbons. And after 3 to 4 carbons, it doesn't have any more ability to be able to pull it into to water to make it water soluble. So each hydroxyl group can pull 3 to 4 carbons into solubility. Which means that if I take a molecule that has a bunch of carbons on it and I add multiple hydroxyl groups, then 2 hydroxyl groups would be times, let's say, 3 carbons. So that's maybe 6 carbons total. So I would expect with 2 hydroxyl groups that I would expect up to 6 carbons would be water soluble. So if this molecule has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, this would be expected to be water soluble. Add 2 more carbons to it and we would probably be at the threshold where it wouldn't have much water solubility. So you can gauge the amount of water solubility of the molecule by looking at the carbon to hydroxyl ratio group or group ratio. OH to carbon ratio. Okay. Water solubility is not a great thing, a great focus of ours, other than in lab, it becomes an interesting question on the solubility. And that was one of the first labs that we were supposed to do in Chem 12A, was we were supposed to look at solubility of alcohols in that first component. And you compared methanol to butanol to octanol and added drops of water, drops of the alcohols into test tubes of water to see how much of that alcohol would dissolve. And methanol is 1 carbon is soluble in all ratios with water. Butanol starts to separate after about 4 or 5 drops. And octanol, the first drop sits on top and will not go into water because the carbon chain is just too long, 8 carbons to 1 hydroxyl group. And it's just too many. So we like to make those connections when we can. Acidity. So Travis mentioned that we had a protic hydrogen, and it's important to remember the acidity that when we look at a carbon hydrogen, that the pKa on these, pKa on a carbon hydrogen is around 60. On a nitrogen hydrogen, it's around 35 to 45, depending on the structure. When we look at an oxygen hydrogen, it's 15 to 18, depending on structure. And then when we get to a halogen, HX, it's somewhere between minus 10 down to minus 3. So I think HF is minus 3. By the time you get to HI, you're at like minus 10 for pKa's. And so that pKa here for an alcohol, something like ethanol, we usually run a pKa that's like 15.7, 16. When you go up to tertiary butanol, the pKa goes up to around 18. And so different alcohols will have different pKa's based on their structure. However, we do need to be careful in that phenol is different than an alcohol. This is a phenol, not exactly an alcohol. It's a special type of alcohol, but its pKa is closer to 10, which is a whole lot less than this 15.7 or 18. And so phenols have their own special properties. Guess I need to take a break for just a second. I got to deal with a dog issue. Let me get one of my brothers to do something. Hang on a second. I'll be right back. So just take me a minute.
What to do with this? Has anyone figured out the good way to kind of like do star charts?
Totally.
Like what? What do you do? Like you just make star charts and more star charts and then you kind of pick the right one?
I have a star chart for the alkenes. It's just a basic star chart that we saw in Zaruba's class and that he's made for us in this class. And then I have a star chart for the alkynes. And that's it. It's on the same. I always have this out when I'm doing anything because I can't do it without it. You're muted, Rito.
Okay. Disaster averted. All right.
Rito, you were muted.
Sorry.
No, everybody's good. Was there a question?
Oh, we were just talking about star charts and how to organize things. So.
Okay. All right. Cool. We'll get the star charts for alcohols too in a little bit. Got to get through some of the reactions first. Let's look at reagents for deprotonation. So oftentimes what we want to do is we want to be able to deprotonate an alcohol. We want to do that for various reasons. We want to be able to turn it into a nucleophile. We want to be able to do other chemical reactions with it. And so there's two main types of reagents. And this is to make nucleophiles. So one of the things that we can do is we can use hydrides, sodium hydride. The hydride, H minus, reacts by abstracting the proton, giving the electrons back to the oxygen. This creates the O minus, for which the sodium becomes the counter ion. And in addition, it makes hydrogen gas. So that's the first type. And there are numerous hydrides. There are sodium hydride, there's potassium hydride, there's calcium hydride. There are many different metal hydrides that are acceptable for this use. The other thing that we can do is we can use alkaline metals. And the alkaline metals, these are sodium, potassium. We don't tend to use, and I put the zero up there, that's really a zero that I'm putting up there. We don't tend to use metals beyond, or lithium. I guess lithium is a good one that we could put in here. And the way that these work is they work by free radical reaction. And they do the same sort of job. So the sodium free radical, and I might mess this up in how this actually works, undergoes the free radical reaction. I'm not going to play with the mechanism. I'm just going to put it this way and say that what we do is we add in sodium metal. And it undergoes the reaction that produces the same thing as before. We are getting now the sodium alkoxide, but in addition to this, we wind up getting hydrogen gas that comes off just like the previous reaction, but it requires two equivalents of sodium and two alcohols in order to be able to do the reaction. But it's the same reaction that you see with sodium and water, where the sodium is just giving up its electron, creating a free radical, and then that free radical turns around, binds with another hydrogen that creates the O minus. And so that's our free radical. And all the alkaline metals will do that. Sodium will do that, potassium will do that, lithium will do that. And the hard part is that these guys also generate a huge amount of heat. And so with hydrogen gas and heat, you can sometimes get flames or explosions, and it has to be done in a controlled way. So the preferred way oftentimes is the hydride, but you'll see people do it with metals quite frequently as well. Let's see, what else do we need to do? Synthesis. Okay, with synthesis, we've got a little bit of review. And then we've got some new parts that are in here. So actually, let's make this a subheading. Let's say that this is review. All the ways that we've seen to make alcohols so far. We can take a leaving group and we can react this with sodium hydroxide as long as this is primary. And we can do an SN2 reaction that takes and converts it to an alcohol. We haven't seen that a whole lot, but it's possible as long as it's primary that it can undergo an SN2 reaction. It's possible that if you take a leaving group on something that is tertiary, and we do water and some heat, that we can get this to go SN1. and we can create the alcohol. So SN2 reactions and SN1 reactions are possible reactions. And then we also had a whole slew of reactions stemming from alkenes, where we could do water and H2SO4, strong acid. And we could protonate it. We could take, and we could do mercury acetate, HgOAC2 with water. And then two, we could do sodium borohydride. That would prevent shifts. And then of course we have the BH3THF. And the oxidation step. And that can do the anti-Markovnikov addition. And so we had all of those reactions to make alcohols from as well. So SN1, SN2, and then a number of reactions from the alkenes. We didn't have any reactions from the alkynes that made alcohols. So we didn't have a way, there was no reactions. If we take an alkyne, there was no way to make the alcohol this way directly. We could do it indirectly. We could step to the alkene, and then we could step to the alcohol, but there was no way to go there directly from the alkyne. So that covers sort of the review part. Now what we've got is new. And the new idea is to be able to take a carbonyl and to reduce it. This is called reduction. And to reduce it to an alcohol. So this is what we're going to focus on, is we're going to focus on this new part and this reduction idea and talk about some different ways of reducing carbonyls to make alcohols as a new idea, a new method. All right. First off, it's good to understand oxidation states. When we start to talk about reductions, we like to understand the different oxidation states that carbon can be in. When we look at carbons, we can go from methane to methanol to formaldehyde to formic acid, and then finally to carbon dioxide. And as we go down the line, oxidation has a couple of, when in Chem 1A and Chem 1B, we learned that oxidation is loss and reduction is gain. And what we mean by oxidation is loss of electrons. Reduction is gain. But besides tracking the electrons, sometimes within organic chemistry, it's easier to track the actual oxygen and hydrogen. And that oxidation within organic chemistry, because we're focused so much on carbon, oxidation can be looked at as the gain of oxygen. And in fact, that was the traditional definition. And reduction equals the gain of hydrogen. So it's the gain of oxygen, or really loss of hydrogen. And reduction is the gain of hydrogen or loss of oxygen. And so oxidation and reduction were really tied to oxygen and hydrogen. And as you can see in going from the left to the right, what I'm doing is I'm gaining an oxygen. This is oxidation. And the oxidation states for these, I can give these atoms oxidation states following the straight up oxidation rules that the carbon, let me put them, I'm just gonna put them on the bottom, but I'll put them on the top. Carbon here is a -4 oxidation state. In this one, it's a -2 oxidation state. In the formaldehyde, it's a 0. In the formic acid, it's a +2. And in the carbon dioxide, it's a +4. And the way that I'm arriving at those oxidation numbers is to take a look at each of the molecules. And the rules for hydrogen are that hydrogen is always +1 when it's combined. So if that's +1, +1, +1, and +1, then the carbon must be -4 in order to balance it. The rule for combined oxygen is that combined oxygen is always -2. And so if I go through the rules here and I look at this being +1 for the hydrogen and +1 all the way around here, and oxygen is -2, then to balance out so that the whole thing becomes neutral, then the carbon must be -2 as well, so that I get 4 positives and 4 negatives. And I can do that continuously as I go through each one of these oxidation numbers, and I can assign the oxidation number to the carbon individually and look at its oxidation number and how it changes. So carbon can run the gamut from -4 to +4 and everything in between, depending upon what it's actually connected to. So there's a little bit about oxidation numbers and looking at the oxidation number of carbon and the gain and the loss of electrons. Now, how do we actually reduce a carbon? And how do we go back this direction? Going back this way, which is reduction. And that's going to be the loss of oxygen or the gain of hydrogen. It's really that gain of hydrogen that becomes important. So let me remind you of a reaction. When we took a double bond and we added hydrogen and platinum, that what we found is that the hydrogen added across the double bond. And we called this hydrogenation. Hydrogenation was a form of reduction. Reduction is the gain of hydrogen or loss of oxygen. Well, there's no oxygen in this molecule, but we definitely gain hydrogen. That was H2, by the way. And so what is the difference between that reaction and this reaction? And the answer is nothing. This is hydrogenation as well. This is reduction. This one can be done at room temperature. This one needs elevated temperatures and higher pressures. And so it doesn't reduce as easily as a carbon-carbon double bond, but it does reduce to an alcohol. And so what we find is that when we take a carbonyl, that carbonyl reacted with hydrogen gas and some metal. So we can just put metal here, and these can be platinum, they can be palladium, they can be nickel, they can be any number of metals. We'll reduce this to the alcohol, adding hydrogen across the carbonyl. It just requires more energy than most of the other reactions. So it requires higher temp. And pressure than alkenes. So it can be selective. So for example, I can take a molecule that's got a double bond in it and a carbonyl, and I can treat it with hydrogen and platinum and reduce down just the double bond. And then if I do hydrogen high pressure and platinum and heat, then I can further reduce it all the way down to the alcohol. And so I can stop before I reduce any of the carbonyls if I want to, because they require slightly different conditions. All right. There are some additional reducing agents. These are called hydride reducing agents. These guys look like this. Sodium borohydride or lithium aluminum hydride. And they will reduce down the carbonyl easier than hydrogenation. And these reagents run a gambit of very strong to very mild. Sodium borohydride is perhaps the most mild of the reducing agents. It can be handled in air. It can be used in alcohols. Lithium aluminum hydride is the opposite end of the spectrum, of which there are many other reagents in between. This must be handled in an inert atmosphere. So an inert atmosphere is something like nitrogen or argon, and explodes with alcohols and water. So it can't get near anything that's protic, or it just spontaneously explodes. In between these, there are many different types of hydrides.
So they're minimally different in the periodic system, sodium and lithium and aluminum and boron.
Uh-huh.
Why is there such a huge difference in strength? Is it the electronegativity difference?
Yeah, it is. Enough? Well, size too. It's size and electronegativity. When you look at hydrogen attached to boron, the electronegativity on boron, hydrogen is 2.3 and boron is 2.0. And so the borohydride bond has a small dipole moment where this is partial minus and boron is partial positive. In lithium aluminum hydride, you have a much bigger aluminum and a different dipole moment. And I have to profess that I don't know what the dipole moment of aluminum is, but I can find it in just a minute.
That's okay. I don't want to derail everything. Sorry.
Okay.
That's like right there in the periodic table. Seems like it's, it's not interchangeable.
It's not interchangeable. No. And so characteristics, dipole moment, heat of vaporization, covalent mass, boiling point density, electronegativity, 1.61. And 2.3. And so the difference in electronegativity is equal to, 2.3 minus 1.61, 0.69. And so it's just a much, what you get out of that is you get an aluminum bond to the hydrogen that has a larger dipole moment. And so you much have a much bigger partial minus to partial positive. And so that makes it just far more reactive. It's just much, much more reactive in that regard. Also, when it forms an 8 complex like this, the 8 complex has a formal charge on the boron and a formal charge on the aluminum. And that formal charge is a formal minus, right? So which one of these is more stable with a minus? When I look at these as stability-wise, usually I would say the larger the element, the more stable it is with the negative charge. But look at the dipole moment, or look at the electronegativity, 1.61 and 2.0. The electronegativity is more important in terms of stabilizing a negative charge than the size is. And the boron can stabilize this much better. It's much happier with that negative charge than the aluminum is. The aluminum wants to get rid of that. And the way that it gets rid of it is it gets rid of it as an H minus. And so when it kicks off that H minus, it gets to convert into the trigonal planar. And it loses the negative charge. And it's much happier that way. So a lithium aluminum hydride just is immensely dangerous to work with. It is extremely reactive. Okay, that being said, how do I choose between these? Because we don't have a lot of different, as I was saying, there are many intermediate, of intermediate strengths. There are red al and I can't remember all the different names. I'm not going to go through them. I'm going to embarrass myself trying to remember all the different names with the intermediates. But there are probably 20 or 30 different hydride reagents that are in the middle here. However, we usually don't use all those. Those are used for specialty types of reactions. Usually it's a difference between lithium aluminum hydride and sodium borohydride. So how do I choose whether I want to use lithium aluminum hydride or sodium borohydride? How do I make the choice between these two reducing agents? Sodium borohydride. Why am I having trouble here? Sodium borohydride is weak. It's good for aldehydes and ketones. Can be used in protic solvents. So mainly, sodium borohydride is a pretty good go-to reducing agent for reducing aldehydes to
primary alcohols and ketones to secondary alcohols. And it can achieve both of those goals. Lithium aluminum hydride, on the other hand, is very hard to handle. It's very strong. It cannot be used, no protic solvents. Reduces aldehydes, ketones, esters, carboxylic acids, amides. It reduces all kinds of things. There's many other functional groups that it reduces. And so if there's any other functional group, such as an ester or carboxylic acid, an amide, or anything that you don't want to reduce, you don't use lithium aluminum hydride because lithium aluminum hydride just sort of reduces everything. Also requires second protonation step. So for instance, if I want to take and reduce this guy with sodium borohydride, I can do it in methanol and it's done at room temperature. It's fairly mild, very easy to handle. If I want to reduce this and I want to use lithium aluminum hydride, the abbreviation is LAH. And it has to be done in THF. It has to be done in an ether solvent. And then number two, it has to have dilute acid added back to it. And it will produce the same alcohol, but it requires multiple steps and it requires special solvents and special conditions. The difference being, if I do something like this, where I have an ester. It's not where I want to put the ester. Let's put the ester at the tail end. And I treat it with sodium borohydride in methanol at room temperature. It will reduce only the ketone. If I do the same molecule and I do it with lithium aluminum hydride, and then I come back and I protonate it, it will reduce everything. And break the whole molecule apart. And so you have to be careful when you choose to use lithium aluminum hydride because of lithium aluminum hydride's ability to reduce other functional groups. That's where the danger comes in. And this is not a reaction that I'm going to go through the mechanism right now with the LAH. When we get into carbonyl chemistry, I come back and we look at these reaction mechanisms and how it tears it apart, and we'll show those reaction mechanisms entirely. But for right now, just know that if there's any other functional groups, that LAH is not necessarily a good choice. So let me show you I was wondering where I had all the different reducing agents. I've got dibol, redal, lithium triethyl borohydride, lab reagents. There's all kinds of different borohydrides. I could show you more structures, but I don't think it's relevant. I don't think we need to. I think the better thing to do is to show you I guess I did go into esters here a little bit. Okay. Deciding what's important and what's not. Also, I don't know what time it is. It's 10:23. So we got 10 minutes, right? Okay, this is important. So I take it back. I am going to show you that mechanism now. Let's look at the ester reduction method with lithium aluminum hydride. So there's lithium aluminum hydride. Lithium is just the counter ion. When we have an ester, like all carbonyls, the carbonyl base has a partial positive. Despite the negative charge being formally on the aluminum, we know that the dipole moment between aluminum and hydrogen means that hydrogen gets a partial minus on it. The electrons that are in the bond cleave and go with the hydrogen. It transfers as a hydride, which is why it's called lithium aluminum hydride. That hydride transfers to the carbonyl carbon and breaks the carbonyl bond. With the carbonyl bond broken and the hydride sitting there, this goes to what we call a tetrahedral intermediate. The tetrahedral intermediate with this structure is very common for all carbonyl type chemistry. And esters have this unique sort of thing built into them, where they have this group that is sitting here that can be a leaving group. And so what happens is this tetrahedral intermediate breaks down by the electrons pushing back in to generate the double bond or regenerate the double bond. This bond breaks and the leaving group takes its electrons with it. That turns the ester into an aldehyde and an O minus that left. Aldehydes are actually more reactive than any other carbonyl compound. And so another equivalent of the hydride reacts with this and reduces the aldehyde very quickly. So now what we end up with is we've had two transfers of hydride. So if I track the hydride and say, all right, here's my hydride. This is the first transfer that makes the aldehyde. And then this is the second transfer where the two hydrogens get planted on there. And I still have this alcohol that was the leaving group. This is the end of the first reaction. And then we come in and we add the dilute acid. The dilute acid is the proton that then protonates each one of these to create the alcohol. And that's where the alcohol step comes in. And that's why I need that protonation in that last step. Because the protonation in the last step adds the proton back to these oxygens in order to make them into alcohols. So that's an important reaction mechanism there in breaking down an ester. And it's important because we're actually going to look at other ways of making alcohols, and we can use aldehydes, ketones, and esters by reduction in order to make alcohols. And esters are an important component of that. So let me keep wanting to check my time, and I keep looking at my clock on my iPad, and my iPad is demonstrating a time that I started this note, not the time that it currently is, which is throwing me off. So when we do this reaction mechanism, here's the selectivity that we see. Oh no, I know what I wanted to do. Let's do this last part. Aldehydes. Ketones. Esters. Amides. Carboxylic acids and carboxylates. These are more reactive. These are less reactive. These are easier to reduce. These are harder to reduce. If I draw sort of a dividing line, sodium borohydride can reduce the aldehydes and ketones. Lithium aluminum hydride with dilute acid can reduce all of them. And so when we use lithium aluminum hydride to reduce an ester, and I'm reducing it and it makes that aldehyde is far more reactive. That aldehyde is the most reactive out of all the carbonyls. It's far more reactive than the ester is. And so there's no way to stop it at the aldehyde. When I go through and reduce this, it reduces all the way down to the alcohol, and there's no way to stop it with lithium aluminum hydride. Lithium aluminum hydride just reduces this thing all the way down to the alcohol, and then it's done. And so there's no way to be able to stop it at the intermediate, at the aldehyde step. And so that's the important component there. There's more here that I want to show you, and I'm worried that if I go into it, that I'm going to go beyond. I'm definitely going to go beyond where we want to go, because I want to go into diols and all kinds of ways of making really cool structures with diols and things, and looking at how far apart the diols are. different ways of getting 1-2 dials, 1-3 dials, 1-4 dials, and how to manage creating dials and getting selective patterns for the dials. That's what we're going to do next time. I think I'm going to cut it here and cut it at the borohydrides at this spot. Okay. So we'll pick up on Monday. Oh, and yes, I need to get you guys a test. You guys need an exam coming up. I might open it up this weekend, but I'll give you lots of time to do it. But I'm definitely going to have a quiz set up for you guys in the Canvas shell, and I'll turn that quiz on. I'll think about the exam, but what I'll do is I will definitely email out and give a clear email of when I put it up and when its due date is. So pay attention to the emails more than the due dates that are sitting in Canvas. And I'll have really clear communication out to you guys in emails, okay? So I'll look at that this afternoon and see what I can do for you this afternoon. And I'll definitely email out. All right?
Beyond the synthesis problems, is there other stuff that we should now be going into to work on?
I think that hanging with the synthesis stuff right now is good. I think that because I think what I want to do is I want to do a test that is going to be through the synthesis stuff that we've covered. So we'll do the alkenes, alkynes, and the synthesis stuff, not going out into the alcohols just yet. So we'll cut it at those three things for the exam. And then we'll start practice problems for the alcohols and working towards the next exam from there. So I would say keep working on the synthesis stuff because that's the relevant skill set that I'm going to give you for this next exam, for this exam that's coming up. And that will practice all the skill sets that we've been doing.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, you guys. See you later.